music artists have been accused of doing this over much. And what was done here, this is from a website called Symphonies of Science. Everything's been tweeted, it's all linked to the Liam show. And what they did basically was match up a bunch of the today's leading scientists or science educators and strung together a variety of songs. If you teach science and you want to motivate your class to get engaged with the material you have to teach them, which is sometimes dry, that might be an interesting introduction, and that's just part of the full video. There's actually a whole bunch of them. There's a whole bunch of them that you can use. So the design elements involved in this, after telling you that it's beautiful, and that it has to be functional, and it's intentional, and it's purposeful, after telling you all that, why would I look at this and say that is an example of good design? It's Saul, yeah. I don't even think the title of the picture. I think it's called a sewer design for light rod. Yes, ma'am.
Well, the old ones were parallel to the street and the light rods got caught.
Exactly, right? They were parallel, they used to be parallel to the street, light rods would get caught, and the rims would bend. And it wouldn't be good if they were perpendicular to the sidewalk either if bikes were walking off the sidewalk at that point. So it's well designed in that sense. So oftentimes, when we think of design, design is not a noun. It's not something that you look at and say, that's design. Design is a verb. Like social media is not a noun, it's a verb. Design is not a noun, it's a verb. It's something that you do. So this definition of design thinking, a multi-disciplined approach to solving problems and tapping into authentic innovation. What that really means is that we look at all the stuff that we have available to us. Whatever you're designing, sewer grates, videos, lesson plans. That there's going to be an element of beauty associated with it, but it also has to be functional, so I will accomplish a very specific goal, and intentional and purposeful. And it's usually an element of surprise in design.
Distraction, confusion, headache, nausea, vomiting, the less useful your talk actually is. Unfortunately, my presentation is right there. Also, there's this, people love to pack data in their presentation. They shove more and more data, thinking it's better, but it's not. The more data you have, the harder it is to read your slide, and the effectiveness plummets. Now, you can improve the effectiveness by adding some shading and some 3D effects, and some second order and third order effects, and then, anyway, let's add some labels, that will help a lot. And that's pretty much every marketing slide I've ever seen right there. This is what the BP marketing standard going, it's real clear in Q4. What the hell are you talking about? Now, I mean to, in animation, people become animators in PowerPoint. You can have things fly all over the place. You have to be good. If you're a visual learner, that will improve the effectiveness of your performance. But if you're easily distracted, more animations and people have no idea what you're talking about. They're just, wow, that is cool, wow. And there's reasons here, by the way. There's the simple but effective reason. There's the active and confusing, the effective and boring, the active and ineffective, all the static region, the busy and useless, the ADD-owned region, the useful but amusing, the super confusing, the bullet triangle, the hyper triangle, the sleepy square, the dizzy pentagon, and everything else that is just called pointless motion. That slide right there took me an hour and a half to make for a bit. PowerPoint is just suck the life out of you, man. I've also come up with this, it's kind of a little science event, it's called font analysis. Basically, the font you choose says something about who you are as a person. There's a huge list of fonts, and you choose one, and that says something about you. So be careful the font you choose. For example, if you choose Courier New, it happens to be my favorite, you're probably going to have a different structure. If you choose Matisse, it means you're artistic. And if you choose Times New Roman, it means you're lazy, apathetic, and imaginative, and you always use the default.
So we can learn a lot from non-examples. Yeah. And if you think about all the assignments that you give your kids, and sometimes they do it by creating a PowerPoint, and we talk about everything else that I call pointless motion, my God, how much of that have you had to look at? Right? So, well, why don't you start your class by maybe showing this 3-minute talk? And saying, this is a thing not to do. Right? Because the way we design our presentations, the slide in there really talks about how we kind of data on the slide. How many of you are using smart boards or meeting boards, interactive whiteboards? I use a smart board in my class, and at the bottom of the page there's a little link there that says extend page. You know what I'm talking about here, right? Don't touch that. Don't ever, because if you have to extend the page, you're trying to squish too much stuff into too little space. I'll give you an example. Have you ever heard of pâté de foie gras? Right? It's a delicacy, right? It's one of the most expensive sorts of foods that we get. It's food slurry, right? So if you're in the business of selling pâté de foie gras, then you're going to want beef with big livers. True story. So the way they do this is, they raise the geese, and they put a metal ring around their neck. A little smaller than the bridge west of their neck. And then they force feed the geese big chunks of food down and down the throats. The natural biological reaction of the geese is to try to vomit it up. Of course they can't because they've got that ring around their neck. And the physiological effect of that is that they get more delivery. Don't try to pack too much information into any one slide or any one presentation that you're trying to give. Don't ever hit that extend page, because if you need to do that, then chances are you're trying to do too much in that space. And in particular, if you're using an interactive whiteboard, the marginal value of hitting new pages is exactly zero. So go ahead and make as many slides as you like. I was going to show this one, but I think I'm going to... I mean, we're going to pause on that one, but that was kind of my backup. If everyone had seen the design matter. The link will be there so that you can go back and watch it. But the point of all this is that if you can't explain something simply, then you probably don't understand it well enough. That's a quote from Einstein. There's a big difference between the words complicated and complex. Complex things don't need to be complicated. And there's a big difference between simple and simplistic. You can explain complicated ideas simply that's not the same thing as being simplistic. Right? It's a real challenge, if you know your stuff well enough, to get something across in a way that's simple. Make complex ideas simple to understand. That's really the ultimate challenge we face as educators. And this segment here, I'm talking about presentation design. This is a topic of presentation design. I thought I might take a couple of examples of what I think are very good presentations, or at least give us an opportunity to talk about what most of this is involved in getting good presentations. This one, which was put together by Garbells, who is kind of a presentation guru. I don't know, have any of you seen this book, Brain Rules? If you read two books this year, this should be the second one. Okay? Absolutely brilliant book. This is Robert Medina. What he does is in the book is he goes and he looks at, he said basically we don't know a whole lot about how the brain works, but there is some stuff that we do know. And it's interesting. He starts off in the front of the book, he says the brain is an organ that has evolved and is optimized to solve problems in a slightly stressful survival type environment, outdoors, while moving. The brain is an organ optimized to solve problems related to survival, outdoors, while moving. Now imagine what your classroom, typical classroom office space looks like. And he unpacks all of that in the book. He then enumerates what he calls 12 brain rules. We don't know a lot, but we know these 12 things. And so in this presentation, Barr pulls out three of them. And he has this to say about the book. It's one of the most informative, engaging, useful books of our time, required reading for every educator and business person. So here's his friend, this is John Medina. He knows how these work. Why is he so happy? Because his book is bloody fantastic. So these takeaways and quotes are based on just three of Dr. Medina's 12 rules. Here they are. The first is that exercise boosts brain power. Know how your brain lights up when you have to sit too long, you need to get up and move around. We're talking about having a walking meeting, or even just having your kids change seats in class. We don't pay attention to the boring things. You got 10 minutes. 10 minutes. After 10 minutes, the brain will stop paying attention to whatever it is you're doing. In my presentation, I try to design something that's going to change every few minutes. I'll put in a video, or tell a joke, or something that kind of changes the pace of things. But you've got 10 minutes. Otherwise, people shut up. And lastly, vision trumps all other senses. Now, have you heard this, of course, that we only use about 10% of our brains. Have you heard that, anybody? Yeah? Okay, so now if that's a true statement, why is it that any type of brain damage is concerning? And if we only use 10% of our brain, it's very flexible, you know, it usually wraps around problem areas, and we're only using 10% of it, any little bit of brain damage shouldn't be concerning. The fact of the matter is, we use all of our brain, and we use it all the time. And what the research shows is that about 80% of our brains are given over to interpreting visual stimuli. Vision trumps all other senses. I even heard one statistic that says that our brains can process an image, a visual image, 60,000 times faster than text. I didn't misspeak. 60,000 times faster than text, which goes to explain why, for example, music videos, quick changing images that resonate, people can actually understand that and follow along. So what if we are taking advantage of this channel into kids' brains? 80% of the brain is over to interpreting visual stimuli. Can you come up with a visual metaphor for what it is that you're teaching that allows the kids to create mental hooks around that thing that helps them remember it? Because they're more likely to remember the image than they are to remember the text that you put on the screen. Second presentation, which I couldn't resist because I love the video. So this is kind of a standalone presentation, and in this presentation, there's all these little text boxes. But I'm going to walk you through it a little more quickly. But you remember that moment in the Matrix, right, where you did that bending backwards thing with, you know, the bullet time? Right? So this is about avoiding bullets in presentations. If I want my students to do any type of presentation, and I often do, then I'll show them this. I'll take that 10, 15 minutes out of class to talk about this and watch the leap forward and the quality of the work that they produce. So, again, if it was only that simple, if you strive for simplicity, you're more likely to reach the viewer. Nice, crisp image with a little bit of text, right? Okay. So the problem with Slideware, like PowerPoint, is you hit a new slide, you get stuff that looks like this. It's almost designed to make you look bad. So what's the problem? Well, people can do this to someone, and of course you're all trying to read it, which is a shame. Let's try it again. The problem there is, like you saw, too much bullet points, too wordy, lots of outcome, lots of little words, and the audience goes to sleep. So that's not great. Maybe once more, most presenters use stuff to do that. Of course, the problem with that is, you put a lot of text up on the screen and they stop listening to you. Now, why does that matter? Well, it makes audiences feel bad. Too many words, too many, say it. Right on. So, when we speak, normally, we speak on average about 150 words a minute. Okay? But people read at about 250 words a minute, which is why they're listening to you. So if you do this, then they're kind of wondering, like, why did I come? Couldn't you just email me the thing? Like, why do I have to be there? Right? And how many presentations have used that to say, wow, you know, an email would solve this and save us all about 3 minutes time. So comes BlackBerry, chance to catch up on your sleep. So how do we get away from all that? So here's an example of a presentation on mentoring staff. Right? So here's what they do. So must-haves. This, and the nice thing is they kind of, you know, introduce it in pieces. But the problem there, of course, is there's still too many words, even too many bullets. So how do we improve it? You notice how it got better? Keywords have been made bold and underlined. Didn't that help? Didn't that help? Keywords, clear vision, receptiveness, and time. So slides like that make me sad, really sad. Let's try again. How about we start with Krista? And one word. And all the stuff that you're going to put on the slide, it's still there, but it goes down into the presenter's notes. That's the stuff you're saying. Okay? And do that twice more, and you get something that looks like that. Now, I got to be honest with you. I still have a problem with that, because I think that color scheme hurts. It's really not nice. The three ideas that I want: clarity, vision, and time, I'm going to want to capture in that one image.
And what I might do, if I was kind of designing something for this,
for that, is I find that image over here on Flickr.
I'm going to hope that the internet's a little snappy. So there it is. So I found that image here on Flickr, and it's got a Creative Commons license on it, which you can see down here. So with that Creative Commons license, that means that I'm allowed to use it. So what I'll do is I'll go and I'll click all sizes and I'll grab the URL for that link. And then I'm going to go to a website called color.org, C-O-L-R, like all good Web 2.0 sites, it drops the last vowel. Now the nice thing about color.org is it presents, you know, these images here, and then it creates a color scheme for them. But the one that I want is my own image. So I just take the URL and paste it in here and have it load that image. So there it is. Now if I need a color scheme that's going to go well and is related to my image, well, there it is. If I click on any of those colors, I usually like to go with three, kind of a pale one, a middle ground one, and a darker one. It kind of gives me the HTML code that I need if you're going to do anything like that in designing. So if you want to design something visually in a document, or if you want to put it on the web, this gives you kind of all the tools that you would need to be able to do that.
So we talked a little bit about design in general. We talked about presentation design, how to design presentation. Let's talk a little bit about, you know, pedagogical design or instructional design. I don't know, have any of you, I'm going to talk about what I call a pedagogical framework. I'm going to go into this in much more detail. I'm going to kind of skim the surface of this a little bit now, but in tomorrow's session, especially tomorrow Friday, I'll go into a little more depth on that. I don't know, how many of you have seen this book, How People Learn? There's a few. Okay, so this, to me, reading this book was absolutely seminal. What they did was they went and it's kind of a meta study. They went and they studied a whole bunch of studies about how it is that people in all walks of life and all ages learn. And they tried to distill those things. So what are the essential key characteristics about how people learn anything? As an outgrowth of that book, they produced this one a little bit later, in 2005 called How Students Learn Mathematics, History, and Science. And those books are free. You can read them online. And the links, my slides all have links in them. I'll show you where you can get them at the end of the session. Anyways, so there's basically what they found was there's three basic fundamental principles about how all people learn anything. The first principle is that students' errors and misconceptions are based on their previous learning. They don't walk into our classroom without knowing stuff. They already know a bunch of stuff when they come in. The example I got up there is one taken from math. Usually, when kids are small, they learn that multiplication is repeated addition. The multiplication is not repeated addition. That's a good place to start, but that's not where you want to end it. Because when they think of multiplication as repeated addition, they end up in a place where in their minds, my answer to this question, whatever, anytime I multiply something, whatever I end up with, is going to be bigger than anything I started off with. So they look at a half times three, and they're like, well, I don't know what to do with that half, oh, but there's a two, and there's a three. And my answer has to be bigger than anything I started off with. Now, I don't know if that's the exact misconception that the students are bringing into your classroom, but maybe that is. Whatever it is, we've got to first in your instructional design figure out how do I pick out what are the preconceptions that the kids are bringing to the table before we start the business of learning. The second principle out of the book is that learning is network. If you pick any idea, think of anything that you teach. Okay, I have a background in senior mathematics, so I apologize if this is going to hurt, right? But like, this has abused kids for years, right? The quadratic formula. And what I think of the quadratic formula, in my mind, I also see a picture of a U-shaped graph. But what I also see on that graph is I see a line cutting right down the middle. And also, I see where that U-shaped graph crosses the x-axis, those two points there. Because the quadratic formula is connected to all those things. And when I see it cross those two points, we call them x-intercepts. But that's also when I think of it as an equation of roots. And when I think of the figure of values of zero. And all those ideas are connected not hierarchically to each other. They're all connected in a network of understandings. And my understanding that I bring to the table as an expert in this area is network. And those networks need to be made explicit to our students so that they can start constructing their own mental models that match the way the knowledge is actually constructed and interrelated. It's not arranged hierarchically. The third principle out of the book is metacognition. That the degree to which you can get kids to think about what they're learning as they're learning will deepen that learning. An interesting outcome of the book, what they found was that with high-performing, high-functioning kids, when they get them to metacognitive strategies in their learning, they found that while they did make gains in their learning, they were all moderate, very moderate gains. But with low-functioning kids that really struggle in all their learning, what they found was that when you engage them in metacognitive strategies, the learning gains are huge. So this is an important, these are kind of the three pieces of the puzzle that have to come together in our own pedagogical design. Now you're familiar with this, it was interesting to hear Mitch Resnick talk this morning. It basically is introducing Scratch, leap to the top of Bloom's taxonomy, kind of saying that you want to move away from working at this level where you ask questions where kids kind of ecologically understand something, and try to move them to the top. And that was revised in 2000. Right? It used to be at the top, they had analyze, synthesize, and evaluate. Synthesize is gone, evaluate is moved down, and creates at the top. Why? Because when kids have to create content that educates, it involves that they bring to bear all those other levels of Bloom's taxonomy. And so it bothers me the way the triangle is designed. I think it should be designed like this, because that more properly emphasizes where we should be working. Now this, I kind of feel an obligation to say. This, I don't think, how many of you have seen this? It's called the learning pyramid. Okay? It's so average retention rates down the side, right? 5% for a lecture, 10% for reading, 30% for a demonstration, 90% for teach other. The biggest hoax in education. It's not true. It's not true at all. It says at the bottom, National Training Laboratories from Bethel, Maine. It's the numbers that aren't true. Someone actually contacted the National Training Laboratory in Bethel, Maine, and said, so there's research, right? The learning pyramid? So, you know, these guys sit there, so if you have sources who did it, you have the papers, and they wouldn't provide the sources. They were pestered. Please, you know, we want to see the sources if we're going to cite this. And the letter that came back was, the research was done here, but we don't know who did it, and we don't have it anymore. And if you scratch the surface of this a little bit, you'll see that it's all a hoax. If you start looking at those links that I put in the show notes online, okay? Where this comes from is what's called, it comes from something called Bayle's cone of experience. And he's not talking about retention rates. The problem is the numbers. You may just stop to think about it briefly, right? 5, 10, 20, like what about humans works out that nicely? Right? And we say reading is 10% and audiovisual reading and seeing is 20%. Like, how do you take those things apart exactly to test how much attention is involved? So there's lots of problems with that. Nonetheless, I still think that this is true. Teaching is listening and learning is talking. Think about it. When you know, when I talk to student teachers, I often tell them that the first, you know, they come back from their first teaching experience, right, and they're white. And I say, you know, it's okay, but there's only one thing worse than your student teaching experience. Your first year. Right? And because your first year, you're entirely on your own, a bunch of new courses you've never taught before. And all of it, the same is true. Like, even if you're given an experienced teacher, it's a new course, something you've never taught before, it's stressful, there's a lot to do. But when that happens to you, what do? You have a new course to teach you've never taught before, what do? Write a lot of materials. Do you sit in the corner and think hard? Maybe you talk to colleagues? Maybe you find someone who's taught the course before? Is it not your experience that teaching a thing, knowing a thing is not the same thing? As a matter of fact, when you had to teach the stuff, your own understanding of the material became so much deeper than when you were just able to do it on your own. So if that's a meaningful experience, if that's a deep learning experience for us as educators, isn't that something that we want to pass on to our students? They did some interesting research with clickers. They found that they put up a question on a board, and they have kids with the clickers to say, so your answer is A, B, C, or D, right? And the kids all click in, and the teacher says nothing. The teacher says, okay, now talk to each other about the answer that you just submitted. So they get 2 minutes to talk, and they put their heads together, they start having a conversation, and they say, okay, we're going to vote again. What do you think? And they ask the same question, right? And the kids re-vote. And what ends up happening is that without any instruction from the teacher, the kids shift to more kids providing the correct answers. In order to test if the transfer was good, maybe it was just because the smart kid pulled everybody the answer. Right? And that's kind of, so what they did was they then gave kids another question on similar material that's related to what they had just discussed together. And they said, okay, vote on it. And when the kids voted on it, they all did remarkably well, much better than kids who go through this without having that interaction. Because the person doing the most talking in a room is the one who wrote among Democrats, and so I apologize at this point. Anyways, getting back to the triangle, it's a riff on Edgar's poem of experience, and when he talks about this is levels of abstraction. A lecture is more abstract than teaching others is more concrete. But as we discussed, teaching others is actually a really deep and powerful learning experience. And it's my view that if you marry those two ideas, Bloom's taxonomy with Bayle's poem, then what you end up with is a recipe for a real, powerful, pedagogical, instructional design. Have kids create content that educates. Whatever you're teaching them, how are you going to create learning experiences whereby they are going to create artifacts that teach others what they have learned? And part of that is going to be influenced by your instructional design, which I'll talk about some more. Now, let's talk about what this looks like concretely in a short-term assignment. Okay, I'm going to touch on 2 examples. So sure, here's one that I did. This is a Flickr assignment. What I did was I had all the kids are walking around with cell phones. And I was wondering that how many kids use their cell phone in a meaningful way to learn. So in my math classes, what I asked them to do was I said, okay, what I'd like you to do is we finished a unit on the quadratic function. And we go off into trigonometry and algebra, other stuff there. And I said, okay, I want you to go back, and I want you, in the world around you, I want you to find a picture that, in your life somewhere, that somehow encapsulates everything you've learned about quadratic functions. And what I want you to do with a picture, a real world picture, is then put it online and upload it to your Flickr account. This is an example of one of those pictures. Now, in the assignment, by the way, the kids were told, since these are being published online, they're not allowed to use pictures of their faces. They were a little like, well, she dealt with that. Okay?
So what happened? What do you do with this picture? And why? What's the big deal about taking a picture and putting it on Flickr? Because there's this functionality that's built into Flickr that allows you to create these hotspots on the image. And so she took a picture of quadratic. This is the mirror, and there is her U-shaped graph. And what she's done is she's identified this is the vertex, and she's created what we call a digital mind map. And everything that she's learned about quadratics is explained on this equation when she talks about x-intercepts, zeros, or roots. She talks about the origin. She talks about how she knows it's opening down, et cetera, et cetera. And then over here on the right, she's got these tags. Now, the quadratic, well, that's the assignment tag. That was the tag that all the kids used to identify their work. But that other tag is kind of arcane, PC30SF06. That tag is my class tag, because I was teaching pre-calculus, the name of the course, pre-calculus 30S, in the fall semester of 2006. That particular mashup of letters and numbers is not likely to be used by other people anywhere else in the world. But my kids are using it, so I go to Flickr, I search on that tag, and what comes up is all the kids' stuff related to that content. This is Sherry's stuff that she did in that class, but there's all this, and this is all my kids' stuff. And so there's a couple of pages of it. Here's another image from the same assignment. This one was when they did an assignment on trigonometry. And this particular picture, this which she calls star trigonometry, is she's got all these hotspots with everything that she's learned about trigonometry. She labels things so she can describe it. It's kind of interesting when the kids started putting in links to other sources to justify the work that they had done, to give backup. And the key to this was not just being able to put it online so that this kid did the work and this kid showed it off, because that's only part of the puzzle. Part of the other, I don't just want, I was talking before about how expert conceives of things in networks. My students aren't experts. And if I only expose them to how experts think of something, I don't know how much I'm helping them, because they're not there yet. So I also need to expose them to the way a novice thinks. I want them to be able to see what's going on inside each other's heads. And that was the advantage of putting it online, is creating this gallery of thought where kids could wade through the thinking of others. So not only this one girl's conception of trigonometry, but everybody in the class, because whatever she missed, she picks up by looking at the work that the other kids did. And that tag that we used, PC30S, set up a Google alert. Now anytime my kids publish something online, they attach that tag to it, and no matter where it is on the internet, it can be found. So I'll give you another example, right, for something that's kind of a more long-term assignment, right? So that was something that might take, you know, I give them, they don't really need a lot of time to do it, but I tend to give them a couple of weeks because I want them to find a good image that they're happy with. Maybe I'll give them a week. But what about long-term assignments? I mean, assignments that stretch over months, like 4 or 5 months. I teach in a semester system. That means I teach full course every 5 months. So I start in September and the course finishes in January. What's that going to look like? So what I came up with was this assignment that I call Developing Expert Voices. And basically, my thinking behind this goes like this. What is it that, my feeling was that if a kid took a course in history, by the time they were done, they should have some understanding of what it is that historians do. That if they take a course in language arts, they should have some idea of what an author or a poet does. And if they took a course in mathematics, my subject area, then they should have some understanding of what it is that mathematicians do. Which, of course, begs the question, what do mathematicians do?
they sit in a corner and do figures all day? No. No, that's not what mathematicians do is they create mathematics. Mathematics is not computation. Myth number one, but I got five. I'll just touch on one. The first myth of mathematics is that mathematics is computation. It's not. It's all about pattern recognition. Anyway, so if mathematicians are in the business of creating mathematics, and if kids take a math course with me, and I want to design their learning experience so that by the time they're done, they have that opportunity to create mathematics, what's that going to look like? So here's what we did. We start off at the beginning of the semester, spend the entire 5 months of the course. By the end of the semester, each kid, they work alone, or a group of two, or a group of three, groups never bigger than three, because three kids are a working group, and four is a social occasion. So they have to create, not copy, four, five, or six, depending if you're a long group of two, group of three, original questions in mathematics. Original, they have to create the problem, they've got to solve the problem, they then have to annotate the solution, explain it well enough so that an interested learner can learn from them. And then, that's all going to be published online in whatever format they choose. And that's what we call the developing expert voices assignment. And in the show notes, the links to the assignment, which along with the copy and the remixes in any way you like, as well as the assessment rubric, which we did collaboratively. The kids, the 70-odd kids and on the online and Google Doc, we collaboratively built the grading rubric for that assignment. And so what they did now, when I was telling the kids this, I was fascinated by this, just talking about the story this morning, just how important the story is. Because I was explaining to the kids, there was a whole conversation when they were designing a rubric. Well, creativity should be part of this, right? And then I said, okay, so then how do you mark creativity? Like, you go over something, okay, I want you to be creative now. It's tough. It's tough. Not only that, how do you know, how do you assess creativity? How do you say, oh, this is 76% creative, and this one, that's only 75. Really? Right? And what does it look like? There's a whole conversation that the kids have, right? And again, they finally decided that creativity should be part of it, but it should live as a bonus mark, up to 5% bonus marks in the assignment. I make the assignment count for 20% of their class mark. They work on it over the entire course of the semester. We've got up with content from a minimum of 2 minutes of study, which works out to more than 20% of the course. Very often, kids pull content all across the course. And they use rather high-level problems. And I say to them, like, if you want to get those bonus marks, one of the things you want to do is if these four, five, or six problems that you're creating, maybe think of it in terms of some kind of story arc that's going to unite all these ideas and pull them all together. Because the way you mash all that stuff together, pulling different content and different ideas from different places, and mix it in a unique and creative way, that gives you the bonus marks. So I'll just show a couple of examples of what the kids came up with. If you ever want to learn calculus in 3 minutes, this is what the kids did. Saying to my students over and over again, right, I'm trying to get away from them thinking about math as computation. And I say to them, mathematics is the science of how. I'll say that over and over again. It's like a mantra. Okay. Anyways, they created a project called Mathematics is the Science of Patterns. And what they did was they went into a video game called Halo. And one of the settings in the video game is you can turn like the camera so it's kind of like a TV screen, and you can actually kind of zoom around the area and look around. So they created all these different characters in Halo that are running around this world in Halo, and they've been given a mission. And today I made an appearance in the video, not myself, some other student voices of my character running around in Halo. And this character kind of sends them off on these missions in Halo, where they run into a quest, oh, what are we going to do? And then the next solve this pre-calculus problem. Right? And when they solve that problem, then they go on to the next phase and so on. So that was the story. So it ends in a cliffhanger. Right? They finally get to the finish last problem, and they run through Halo and they say, okay, Mr. King, we're here, we've got the solution. And he said, let me have to tune in next year to find the answer. Because these kids were taking pre-calculus with me 1 year, in the grade 11 year, they knew that they were going to take 80,000 with me the following year, and they, you know, they get to my job, they know they're going to have to do another one of these. So this was the follow-up. Now in this one, my 80,000 class that particular year starts with 19 students. And you know what that's like? Not everybody survives. So 10 students wrote the final exam. So actually, the three original students that put together MITSOP, Mathematics and Science Patterns, one of them actually didn't make it, so they picked up a new student, and then they created this, which they called Calculus Survivor Islands. And it became like a whole multimedia thing. Like, the kids in this assignment, so the first thing I asked them to do is I say, okay, first I want you to copy, not create, four problems, five or six. And hand them in to me, and let me see if you're kind of on the right track, and I go meetings, right? And then after that, they have to design a timeline, which they publish on the blog, about when we're going to have all the work done at different points across the semester. And then they do that, and then they have to stick to their timelines. And then each kid on Google Calendar chooses their own publication date. I say, this is the absolute final deadline, which is usually just before the final exam. And then I say, but think about it, you all have busy lives. Kids are, you know, they're in high school. You've got assignments in other classes, some of you are working part-time, you've got stuff going on in your life, birthdays, family events, whatever it is, pick your own deadline. This is the absolute latest, but that's not the one you're supposed to pick. You're supposed to pick the deadline that makes sense for you, which they did, and then that all gets public on the calendar on the class wall, so everybody can see that. Anyways, they pick their deadline, and like 3 weeks before they're supposed to publish, a poster gets published. Of like these three guys in Halo, right? And all these action points. And then before that, they release a week before the thing is actually published, they publish these teasers. Once the other kids, like little commercials of what was going to happen when they published their assignment. And this is one of the teasers. Right? That it should be tightly tied to how it is that people learn. In this example, this, I don't know this fellow, Dr. Jay Lair, he wrote a paper. Paper's available online and show notes. He said, let there be snowmen. He was asked, he's a scientist. I think he's an oceanographer or geographer. Might be a geologist. Anyways, it's at a symposium, right? A scientific symposium. And all the presenters have, and they're supposed to give 20-minute talks. And one fellow comes to the symposium, and he comes and he stands at the podium. And he's got this room of paper that he keeps his head down and he's reading for 20 minutes straight with his eyes down. Behind him across the screen are flashing the most complex slides imaginable, going across at a lightning speed while he just keeps talking for 30 minutes. At the end of 30 minutes, he finally lifts his head and finally makes eye contact with the audience and says, I hope that it helps make it clear to you what the connection is between the Rock of Gibraltar and the Ring of Fire, or some other such nonsense, right? And Jay Lair, the Master of Ceremonies, begins to tear a strip off, goes up one side and down the other. How dare you come to a symposium of colleagues who are here to learn from you, who want to spend their time engaged in meaningful dialogue and learning with you as their leader, and you should abuse them like that. And he in front of 200 people, he said, these people didn't even leave the room. How dare you do this? And people, like, can you imagine? Could you imagine if the keynote had thousands of us? Something like, what? Right? So, anyways, this is what he says. He says, on the importance of, now it's not my habit to read slides after everything I said. But this is powerful stuff, right? Jay Stair's failure to spend class time wisely and well, failed to educate, entertain, elucidate, enlighten, and most important, to maintain attention and interest should be punishable by stoning. There's no excuse for tedium. Dull conference speakers, he says, are not sophisticated erudite scientists speaking above our intellectual capacity. They're arrogant, thoughtless individuals who insult our very presence by the lack of concern for our desire to benefit from a class which we chose to attend. On reading class notes, there's never an excuse to read notes. Better to lower the level of verbal excellence and raise the level of extemporaneous activity and energy. On using slides, which were overhead projectors in those days, right, 35-millimeter thing, they must be brightly lit, convey a simple thought, and you need a pointer to indicate an important concept the slides to visit. So what does all this look like when it's actually brought all together and someone's actually going to teach you something like what happens in the classroom? Have any of you seen Dr. Baxter? No. One of my favorite scientists. I'm only going to let you watch her for 2 minutes. She actually goes on for 20. I'm only going to show you two. Okay? A little more than two. Watch this.
They've been here for billions of years, and what they are single-celled microscopic organisms. So they're one cell, and they have a special property that they only have one piece of DNA. So they have very few genes and genetic information to encode all of the traits that they carry out. And the way bacteria make a living is that they consume nutrients from the environment, they grow twice their size, they cut themselves down in the middle, and one cell becomes two, and so on and so on. So they just grow and divide and grow and divide. So kind of boring life, except that what I would argue is that you have an amazing interaction with these critters. I know you guys think of yourself as humans, and this is sort of how I think of you. And so this man is supposed to represent a generic human being, and all the circles in that man are all the cells that make up your body. So there's about a trillion human cells that make each one of us who we are and able to do all the things that we do. But you have 10 trillion bacterial cells in you or on you at any moment in your life. So 10 times more bacterial cells than human cells on a human being. And so of course it's the DNA that counts. So here's all the A, T, G's, and C's that make up your genetic code and give you all your charming characteristics. So you have about 30,000 genes. Well, it turns out you have 100 times more bacterial genes playing a role in you or on you all your life. And so, at the best, you're 10% human, you're more likely about 1% human, depending on which of these metrics you like. So I know you can think of yourself as human beings, but I think of you as 99% bacterial. trees are incredibly important. They keep us alive. They cover us in an invisible body armor that keeps environmental insults out so that we stay healthy. They digest our food. They make our vitamins. They actually educate your immune system to keep bad microbes out. So they do all these amazing things that help us and keep and are vital for keeping us alive. And they never get any press for that.
2 minutes.
Yeah.
Right? In 2 minutes. Let's unpack what she did in those 2 minutes, okay? So what did she do? She went through 5 slides. Right? 5 slides in 2 minutes. She also uses a black slide. I don't know if you noticed towards the end there on the screen behind her, instead of showing her slide, they're showing her, because there's no slide, because she doesn't want you paying attention to any slide. Who's the presentation? She did the presentation. It's not the slide, look at her, which is what we did. Right? And then she does all that in 2 minutes and 22 seconds. Overall, she took some really complicated ideas and made them simple. Remember, right? Simple and simplistic is not the same thing. And complex doesn't have to be complicated. She then tells us things that are unexpected. Right? Like the difference between bacteria and human, that you're only 1%. And she's credible after all this Dr. Bonnie Bassler. Concrete stuff. She tells these are the bacteria. They're actually on you. And in the next section of her talk, actually, she talks about the bad ones, right? And all the things that can go wrong. And she actually shows us what they look like. And emotional, right? She obviously, you can tell she's engaged with the material. She's passionate about what she's talking about. And she's worked in some humor, right? Humor releases all kinds of chemicals in the brain that makes it so much easier to learn. Can you hear when you're upset? And then there's a story, right? You kind of want to know how it ends, right? Story is an incredibly powerful technique that you can use if you can attach what you want to teach onto a story that's filling with a set of images, then you really are powerful. You can do all of those things, and what you've got is called success. And if you read 3 books this year, this should be one of them. Okay? And it's called Made to Stay. How many of you read this? Okay, so like you all have some good reading to do. I am reading. Because in the book, it's a book about how to make ideas sticky. And I don't know anybody who's in the business of making ideas sticky like teachers. Right? And they actually have some resources there. How teaching that sticks. How to make your teaching sticky. And they have this kind of, they summarize the 6 chapters in the book as success. Right? If you can tell a simple, unexpected, concrete, incredible, emotional story, and you got it all, and you got something that you really want to say. In the book, they talk about actually where one of the examples they get is a fellow, and I won't tell you the story, but the fellow who discovers that the reason that we get ulcers is actually associated with bacteria. It's not a physiological thing, it's a bacteriological problem. So this is another presentation that I'm going to go through very quickly, just a little bit of it. And here's one that is kind of, it's a standalone presentation. It's a story of age, a story of survival. It's a story of battles, wars, and victories. This is a story about age, a bacteria that lives in my stomach. Helicobacter pylori, spiral-shaped bacteria. It's in a conflict, and inside my stomach is bathed in about 2 liters of gastric juice every day, a deadly bath with digestive enzymes and acid. Gastric acid is so strong that it destroys human tissue on contact. Everything dies inside. Everything. But age. H adapts. It creates a cloud of acid neutralizing chemicals around itself. This makes it the only creature that can survive down there. H is a warrior. Every day my immune system sends mighty armies, assassins, to kill H, but they cannot touch it. It blends into its surroundings. Can you see that, the word blends, because, rather? That it's kind of an image of the bacteria behind it. When you're doing a presentation, when you're talking about effects, right? If you don't put any, like one effect in a presentation is a lot. And in this case, the only time you should use an effect in a presentation is if the effect actually underscores the point you're trying to make verbal, as in this example here. So what does all this look like when it's brought to bear in your class? As I was thinking about all this, and I said, so how am I going to bring this all to bear into my first class? I'm also thinking about, so I'm going to talk to you with some of the ideas I've been thinking about. How are you going to bring it to your class if you leave here? And some of you are going back to class next month or the following, August or September. So what are some ideas I can leave you with? Well, this is what I've tried to do. I've decided that it's not something I can do necessarily every single class, but maybe over time, build up to being able to give that kind of presentation. But as a first class of the year, I want to knock their socks off. This is what I try to do. And when kids walk into class, that's what they see on the screen. It's a quote from Frank Smith. So like I said, if you read three books this year, one of them should be by Frank Smith. It's called The Book of Learning and Forgetting. All learning pivots on who we think we are and who we see ourselves as capable of becoming. Remember, I teach math. A lot of kids who walk into my classroom are mathematically wounded. They're convinced they can't do it. So that's how I start. And then I show them this video, which I'll show you too. The question is, what does it have to do with school? It's only about a minute long, a little less.
This probably late.
Somebody will come.
Can I go?
No. Sorry. Hello! There are two people stuck on an escalator and need help. Now, would somebody please do something? Believe this. You gotta be kidding me.
Remember what I said with humor and learning, okay? Right off the hop, they're convinced they can't do it. They're walking into the first math class. And what does this have to happen to the school, of course, the sense of learned helplessness, right? We want to get over that as quickly as possible. And I want them to learn what mathematicians do. I talk about how they're going to create mathematics. I tell them that, and then they say, well, I can't do that. I suck at that. I can't. I say, well, that depends on how you see yourself. If you see yourself as capable of doing it, then you will be able to do it. Right? Don't set barriers for yourself that are self-imposed. And I talk about time. Being on time for class is important. It's polite and considerate. Numbers, it's a math class. We talk about some numbers. In a semester, we have about 100 days, but really only 80. Right? Because you got, like, you know, there's professional development days, and there's going to be a rally, and then there's going to be this, and that, or a fire drill, and there's a class. It's all those things. I said, well, then there's going to be 80 minute tests. There's really only 72 tests, and I have to teach 110 hours and I have 1 hour of classes. And then the kids go, oh, right, I want to make some points. And 12 is another important number in our class, because after you miss 12 classes, well, if you miss two, after you miss 12 classes, you can't get credit. You can continue to audit the course, but you can't get credit. That was in my school. Two absences means I'm going to call home. Six absences, you get another call and a letter. The 12 absences, then you know you lost your credit. These are the stuff that you need to bring to class, so these are all the things. And I go a little more slowly with the kids. Critical path to success involves attempting all your homework assignment. And this is not what I mean when the homework assignment says extend. And I don't know if you can see how he wrote that. Review all your class notes before going to bed. Why do you do that? Because of the curve of forgetting. In a 1 hour lecture, within a day, you're going to remember only 20-40% of what you were told, right? A month later, you're going to remember only 3%. And the exam is 5 months away. What are you going to do? Well, if you review the material for 10 minutes, you can bring your learning back up to close to 100%. Reviewing it a second time and half the time, you bring it back up to 100%. Reviewing consistently, it gets faster and faster. And we'll talk about that in class. Of course, ask lots of questions. There's only one stupid question. The one you didn't ask. And always get extra help from the teacher when you feel like you're falling behind. Make sure you get form a study group, preferably with people you don't know. Right? Because it's not supposed to be a social occasion. We talk about the 3 as a study group, 4 as a social occasion. Make them have it set at the same time of day in the same place where you're always doing your homework. And then talk about the class blog. Every class has their own blog where all the work they do in that class gets aggregated there. And I say, so what you're going to need to do is kind of get yourself a Google account. That's a link to a video online that walks them through a screencast of how to set up a Google account. We're going to need a Blogger account or other screencasts. Of course, don't forget that yes, you can do this. If you think you can do this, then you can do this. If you think you can't, you're probably right. It depends on how you see it. Of course, here's your homework. try these four images in text. Send me an email. Get your Google account, get your Blogger account. And by the way, tomorrow's class, I'm going to talk about circular functions. And this is the question I want you to think about. Why are there 360 degrees in a circle? Like, where did that number come from? Like, wouldn't 100 have been easier? Like, why 360? What's the point? Isn't that silly? Where's your degree? We'll talk tomorrow. And have a nice day, and don't forget your homework. And that's how the class ends. And I credit all the images that I need to set up. Right? And that's your first class. It takes about an hour to go through all that with that, right? It's one class, right? But there's all the other stuff, the administrative involved in the first day of class, etc. So my challenge to you, the sixth of the seven principles of learning that's published in this book, Learning and Understanding, from the National Academies Press, also another free book online. The sixth one says, the practices and activities in which people engage while learning shape what is learning. So if I have any influence on your thinking at all today, then we need to do something to, about that. And so I have a challenge for you. In the game, I'm going to show you what it looks like. And I want you together, because this comes out of the same book, right? It's only by encountering the same concept at work in multiple contexts that students can develop a deep understanding of the concept. You have to work with the material in various places before it really makes sense and build your own network of understanding of how all the pieces hang together. So how are we going to hang together our discussion of design, the presentation design, and instructional design? Maybe we should play together.
So I want you to design something. And this is the web page. So the link that I gave you goes to this. This is my archive of everything that I'm doing here at BLC. And the first one is called Design Matters. That's where you are today. And you can review. All the links that I've clicked on are actually active on the slide. So you can actually just click on the slide. I've recorded most of the audio. Actually missed the first 5 minutes. I'm sorry. But the rest will be there. And I'll publish that here. I'd love to get feedback from you. And let me show you a little bit about what happened with the slideshow that you all made together. All the pictures that you took. I'll come back to that in just a moment. But what I'd like to challenge you is join this Flickr group or try this. In this group on Flickr that I've kind of linked to, is there's teachers from all over the world that are contributing a meaningful quote about learning and change, attaching it to a powerful image, and sharing it there. So milk that in your classes, milk that when you have to talk to colleagues, milk that when you have to talk to your students. Not clearly exactly why we would talk to our students and colleagues about different things all the time. A lot of stuff we say to each other, we should probably say to our students.
And so you can get all that stuff there. But also, I'll let you explore this on your own, but I'd like you to, all together, let's see if we can build a presentation.
I call this presentation tennis. Learning happens. You complete that sentence. Learning happens.
And find an image. Here's an example. I decided to go with this. More often when we put our heads together. So here's the presentation. Learning happens, a tale of divergent paths. More often when we put our heads together than when one person talks to us.
Then start a new contrasting pair. Whatever comes next, I've got a blank slide. You add, it's a Google Doc, it's open. If you've got a Google account, you'll be able to jump in. Contribute a slide. Learning happens. And whatever that person says, the next person should contrast whatever they said. And then we'll start off another contrasting pair. When we get towards the end, whoever ends up doing those last couple over the next 3 days, whoever contributes that last one, remember that we're kind of coming to an end, right? Because design is not a noun, it's a verb. And we learn by doing.
So that's kind of my invitation to all of you to join there. With that said, I'm going to leave you with the pictures that we were showing, because I'm out of time.
Thank you.